and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who are very, very excited about the special guest we have today. We are your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. I think that you meant to say starstruck, Angie.
Starstruck, yes.
Yes, the man is in the house today. I can't wait for you to introduce him. But before you do, I'm going to introduce our topic. It's kind of a dirty little topic that nobody really wants to talk about, but everybody also wants to talk about. And everybody seems to have an opinion. And some people have very strong opinions. So I'm glad that we have our guest here today to help us kind of figure this out. But we're talking about modern attachments, hyperlinked files. Before we dive in too deep, Angie, would you like to give us an introduction?
I would love to. So we are thrilled to welcome a very special guest, the illustrious Doug Austin. Since 2010, Doug has been daily blogging and has also published, since 2020, the industry-famous, critically acclaimed blog, eDiscovery Today. His blog has received the JD Supra Reader's Choice Award for Top eDiscovery Author, and he's been ranked by the same publication as a top cybersecurity author. Doug has also presented at the biggest eDiscovery conferences in the US, including Legal Tech, ILTACON, Relativity Fest, University of Florida eDiscovery Conference, the Masters Conference, and many other local and regional conferences. He also has over 30 years of experience providing eDiscovery best practices, as well as legal tech and consultant management services to commercial and government clients alike. And so, without further ado, welcome, Doug.
Gosh, I should probably just leave on that note. that's very, very kind introduction. So thank you, Angie, for that. And I'm excited to talk about modern attachments. Oh, I just said the word. So
Oh, no.
Well, I mean, after that introduction, I feel like I'm totally not worthy. But thank you, Doug, for taking the time out to talk with us, especially about this topic. I heard a little rumor that you like to tell jokes. Specifically dad jokes. So I didn't know if you might have something that you'd want to share with us.
I tend to get to be known for my puns and my dad jokes. All my family certainly knows that. My kids gave me a t-shirt a year or so ago that says, I keep all my jokes in a database. So that was clever. It's even gotten into my work scenarios. So I do a monthly webinar with EDRM and always do it with the same people, with Mary Mack, who's the CEO of EDRM, and Tom O'Connor, who's, you know, been in the industry forever, and Judge Peck, who of course has had so many famous eDiscovery rulings when he was a judge. And they've literally taken over-unders on how many puns I'll have during the webinar. Yeah, it's just something I would like to stop, but I just can't seem to stop. So it is what it is.
I love a good dad joke.
I need to start listening for that during your monthly webinars, which are fantastic. For anyone who hasn't listened to these, they're put on monthly by the EDRM and eDiscovery Today. The series is called Important Case Law Decisions, and they do it every month. And it's a really wonderful way, if you've got an hour, to just get up to speed on the happenings of the last month.
That's a cool reminder. Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, I guess we're joking around about them being dirty words, but today we're talking about modern attachments. I know that we have a lot of our listeners who are new to eDiscovery, or maybe eDiscovery isn't part of their day-to-day. Just to kind of get us all on the same page before we get started down this road, I didn't know, Doug, if you could kind of share with us a brief history of what is a modern attachment? Why are we talking about it? What's important?
Sure. And it really comes down to kind of the history has been historically, I mean, email's been around for decades. It started where all the email installations have been on-premise in different organizations. Files were on-premise. And when you send an email with a file you wanted to send along with it, you attached it physically as an embedded file within the email. And you sent it out to the other person in your organization, outside your organization, what have you. It was always a packaged email and attachment that we've come to call an email family, email and multiple attachments. And sometimes those attachments can be several levels deep, because you could have an email within an email and even, you know, two or three levels deep, and then attachments within those. But they were all point in time static, sent from one person to another, and there was no problem. You had it all there and you could process through it, and you would have the ability to have the attachment and the email all within that particular email that was sent. What's happened in the past several years is the move to the cloud. And now these days we have email solutions in the cloud. We have file solutions in the cloud like OneDrive and SharePoint and Google Vault and what have you. And a lot of organizations, understandably so, instead of sending a physical attachment within an email to somebody, they're sending a link to one of these file stores and linking to the file instead of sending the physical attachment. That's great. And there's a lot of benefits from the standpoint that doing so means you don't have so many redundant copies around of that file within the organization and what have you. But the problem is when you get to e-discovery time, that you don't have the attachment as part of the email, you have a link to it. And that file may be difficult to get to. It may no longer even be there. It may have been edited since it was sent. That's the challenge, the technical challenge that has become what we're talking about here with modern, what we call, quote unquote, modern attachments, where it's a linked file instead of a physical attachment embedded in the email. And that's causing all sorts of technical challenges for e-discovery professionals today.
Do you think it would be fair to say that even though things have moved into the cloud, they're less dreamy than they were before?
Well, there we go.
Wow. Oh, started no. That's with a good the dad one. Joke. Where he's like, oh no, there's two of them.
Yeah. I'm surrounded, people.
Yeah, so that really is, that's the challenge. And a lot of organizations have run into those challenges. And we've had some case law where the parties have debated the issue because until recently, the past few years, I don't think a lot of parties were even thinking about this as an issue. Now we're starting to see cases where they've already agreed to an ESI protocol that handled it one way. And then they've kind of learned that, well, we're running into some, either we thought we were going to get something for the requesting party we didn't get, or the producing party agreed to something that's really technically challenging. And it's causing some challenges throughout organizations everywhere in terms of how to respond to it.
So Andy and I are really big on lingo. In fact, we every Friday have a Learn the Lingo post on LinkedIn, mm-hmm. trying to, you know, define some of those keywords, the jargon and the e-discovery industry. So when I hear about modern attachments and people ask me about them all the time, commonly people will say modern attachments, linked documents, and hyperlinks. Can you give us more of a definition of what these things mean and how they differentiate from one another?
Well, let's put modern attachments aside because that's the term that a lot of people are quibbling with. Certainly, linked documents and hyperlinks or linked files, because I think you could say linked files or linked or hyperlinked files. To me, the kind of some of the considerations there is that you can hyperlink to anything. You can hyperlink to a website. You can hyperlink to, you know, anything that's out there that has a URL. But that's something we've always been able to do. We've had emails for decades that might have a hyperlink in it to some website. Might be public facing, and you can get to it easy. Might not be, but regardless, that's something that's always been a challenge. Linked files, on the other hand, is a case where you have an actual hyperlink to a file instead of the file embedded. And so to me, that terminology is one that I'm really trying to push people towards because people keep saying, well, I just shouldn't have to produce anything off my website if you link to it. And that's really not the issue we're talking about here. We're talking about something you used to have just that you took for granted that's now less certain, and that is the ability to get those hyperlinked files. Whether you call it hyperlinked files, linked documents, I think it's still the same thing. You know, you link to a Wikipedia page, no big deal. Anyone can go to that and get what they need. But if you link to a file that might be in somebody's SharePoint or OneDrive or Google Vault, and the requesting party has no access to that, that's something that, you know, can be important if that file could conceivably be responsive to the case.
So, Doug, you've been writing a series of posts about this issue of hyperlinked files. And for any of our listeners who are curious, we will link to those in our show notes of today's episode. And it is a 5-part series, I believe. And is it now 6 parts as of today?
And it's now 6 parts as of
today. Exciting. So, yeah. so it is a now 6-part series on this exact issue. So my question to you, in that series, you've identified a list of 5 assumptions about this issue, but you've also written about the case law, the interplay of federal rules of civil procedure, and other related issues. What drove you to write about this? Why now? Why these topics?
There was a case about now 3 years ago called Nichols v. Noom, where that was one of the first cases that I think we saw where the modern attachments issue was an issue, where the plaintiffs and defendants agreed to an ESI protocol. The defendants started producing documents and the plaintiffs realized, wait, there's links to files here. We thought we didn't expect these. And then they had to go to the court and sort it out. The judge in that case, Judge Parker in New York, said you didn't really have it specified what an attachment was defined as, and they've already produced it one way. They don't have to go back and produce it again. There were people who actually submitted amici briefs and what have you because they weren't crazy about the decision. They thought they should have been treated as quote unquote modern attachments. Then last year, the case that came along was in Re StubHub. They had an ESI protocol where StubHub agreed to produce them as modern attachments. And they ran into problems and they couldn't do it. And I wrote about the case. And then I started hearing from people that said, oh, they shouldn't have to do that. You know, that we can't really treat those as modern attachments. So that was the first time I learned there are people on both sides of the issue. So I wrote about it just from a standpoint of, here's the issue, here's some of the case law we know about, and put it out on LinkedIn, tagged a bunch of people, and it blew up in terms of discussion. And a lot of discussion came back and forth about the issue and whether they should be treated as modern attachments, they shouldn't be treated as modern attachments, and so forth. But one of the things I learned from that first post is that a lot of people weren't really framing the issue properly. They were saying, well, a link to a web page, I shouldn't have to produce that. I may not even have this file. So then it became clear that it probably made sense to have a second post where I could say, let's define some assumptions, let's agree to all those, and then we can kind of keep the discussion moving forward. So that was my second post, and you referred to the 5 assumptions that really kind of got the ball rolling and pushing it that direction. And even still today, I just saw a comment from somebody on the LinkedIn post who's kind of going back to some of those things that are outside the assumptions. So I think that's one of the things I'm going to have to probably continue to push is, hey, let's focus on just what's in the assumptions. This is the issue we're talking about.
So, okay, you referenced your 5 assumptions, and I want to drill down into those a little bit more. I love these assumptions, and I read that post. It really clarified the issue for me in a very big way. So I would love to bring those to our listener base and dive into them. So your first assumption is that this issue relates solely to hyperlinked files and not all hyperlinks. You've kind of touched on this, but can we drill down into that a little bit more? And will you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, the whole quote unquote modern attachments was basically files that were physically attached in emails. People were, when I raised with the initial post, said, well, what about hyperlink file to a Wikipedia page or to my company page or what have you? And I said, no, this is really, we're talking about files here. And this is something we've always had the ability, you know, the communication had the email and they had the attachment and it was all one nice, neat package. Now we don't have that because that embedded file is now a link. That's the key. We want to focus on this as it relates to files, not hyperlinks. And of course, you know, someone might say, well, what about a link to an internal website or something like that that's in control of the responding party? That's an issue, but that's always been an issue. So that's still something that parties have had to negotiate and figure out and, you know, and so forth. But in terms of what the core issue here is compared to the way it used to be, it's hyperlink files are the core of the issue.
Gotcha. And you know what? I feel like that dovetails really nicely into your second assumption, which relates to possession, custody, and control. I know that the federal rules of civil procedure kind of dictate a lot of these assumptions and the way that we're treating those. Can you touch a little bit on why it is that in order to produce something under the federal rules, it must be within the possession, custody, or control of the party that's actually trying to produce that thing and how that plays into this dispute.
So first off, the federal rule that we're talking about, Federal Rule of Civil Procedure, Rule 34A1, specifies that parties may only request the production of documents or electronically stored information in the responding party's possession, custody, or control. So what that means is that they may, that party that produce, that the responding party may have worked with other companies, and they may, the files may have gone back and forth. If it's not in the responding party's control, you can't request it from them. You may have to go request it from a third party. To me, if we're talking with the assertion, the first assumption being it's a hyperlinked file, the second assumption has to be it has to be in the responding party's possession, custody, or control. One of the things I think we see these days is situations where companies and their partners may be on Slack channels or Teams channels or what have you, sharing information back and forth. At some point, maybe there's a change in or in structure, and parties are no longer connected in these channels. And then you go request files from one party, but it was really the other party's domain where those files resided. You got to go to them for it. And so that's the key. You can't produce something you don't really technically own or have. And so that's the key. In terms of public files, again, you can get to it. If you can get to it, it doesn't really matter. We're talking about files here that you can't get to, and only the responding party should only be responsible for those files that are in their possession, custody, or control.
You know, I immediately, in my mind, I'm like, no, I do not want to produce a linked file or a hyperlinked file. How do I know that it's the right version? I mean, maybe this Word document said something completely different a year ago when I referenced it than it does today. And I know these are some of the back and forth arguments that people have talking about treating hyperlinked files as attachments. What are the arguments that are out there? What are the strongest ones for and against, I guess? And what side are you on? That's the most important part of this question.
Yes. Okay. Well, first of all, I think the arguments come down to the technical ability and the burden for doing it. Probably given enough time and resources, organizations could probably manage to do just about anything. But is it proportional to the needs of the case, which will be an assumption we get down a little further to. But you mentioned, Bree, you mentioned version of files, and that's one of the big challenges, because you may not always be able to get back to that version of the file that was sent at the time it was sent. So what do you do? And that comes into a question of, well, there's another version of the file there. Is it good enough? So those are some of the gray areas we get into. One of the things I, of course, got into with assumption three was, hey, if a file, then you can be sending a file, 2 years to 2 years back, and then you get to litigation, and that file may not even be there anymore. You can't produce what you don't have, so that's something we can certainly all agree on. Now, the version question is more of a challenging one. What we're starting to see is Microsoft Purview is providing an ability to track the versions of the files, and Google announced something back in December where they're starting to provide that capability. So I think the technology is moving to where they're addressing that issue. But those are just two email and messaging solutions out of who knows how many. So it's going to be an issue for quite some time, and certainly each system is going to have unique challenges in that. I think the question is it going to be the right version? What's the effort and burden going to be? While on the other side, I think the requesting parties are really kind of coming down to, it's part of the evidence. It's part of the communication that was sent. I've literally done myself instances where I've had a discussion with somebody, and I would send an email and say, as discussed, with an attachment or a link to a file, and that email is going to tell you nothing about the content and of the discussion and what have you. It's all in the attachment. You can't just count on the email to be really helping you determine what the communication is. The communication in complete is going to be that email plus that attachment linked or embedded. And that's the thing that the requesting party position is versus the producing party. I feel like, yes, you have to produce the evidence, and there should be every effort to do so. But I do recognize that some technical challenges make it very burdensome to do so. And that's why right now, I think there's instances where a case can be made where you can do some other things and do the best you can. And it may not be fully true attachments type of scenario. But I also think the technology is evolving where those issues won't be as big as they used to be.
So Doug, I want to move on to your third assumption, which is that if a file doesn't exist, it doesn't get produced. Can you explain what you mean by this assumption and why it's so important in the context of this discussion?
When I sent the original wrote the original post, some people were talking about, there's broken links or links to files that don't exist anymore. And obviously you can't produce those, but of course you can't be bailed out with a file that is deleted once the duty to preserve begins. You still have to have you've got to have a duty to preserve, and you've got to preserve potentially responsive ESI. If we're talking about a file that, you know, is older than the email or message, and it maybe could have been defensively deleted before the duty to preserve began, an organization can't produce what they don't have. So to me, I think that's the key. One of the things, of course, I noted in my assumptions is that's clear cut. Versioning is not clear cut. It's more of a big can of worms. You know, that's one of the things that I think have to be kind of looked at there. I think we can all agree that if a file was deleted before the duty to preserve began, nothing you can do about it. Can't be produced. There's just nothing that, the organization can do, the producing party can do. And the requesting party just has to accept that.
Gotcha. And I do want to dive into this versioning question like a little bit later, probably when we get into discussing today's post. So we'll have a moment to nerd out about that. Let's crank through the rest of your assumptions. So assumption number four, this is your second to last one, is that hyperlinked files should still be produced if they're relevant, regardless of this whole debate. What do you mean by that? And why is it so important?
Well, so one of the things I think I'm not sure everybody was clear on is, let's say you're going down the path of trying to find responsive emails in Exchange or Outlook or Google or Gmail or what have you, and they're linking to files, okay? So you may have enough to find certain responsive emails that may or may not be, you know, have enough information to determine responsiveness. You also have these data stores. You have Google Vault if you're a Google customer. You have OneDrive and or SharePoint if you're a Microsoft customer, as examples. And those files, if they have responsive information, they should be still produced. That you may or may not be able to easily establish the link to the emails from which they were sent, but at the very least, they should be produced standalone, if nothing else. So that's all I was really trying to say is those repositories still have to be searched and those files still have to be produced if they're responsive to the case, irrespective of whether they were sent.
Right. So we're really talking about that link between the file and the parent document, whatever that is.
The link between the email and the file that it was linked to is the challenging part. Absolutely.
Let's round out our discussion of your assumptions. So assumption number five, the final assumption, is that regardless of anything else, discovery of hyperlinked files must be both relevant and proportional. How does this relate to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure? And why is this assumption so important for this debate?
Well, and this is really where a lot of the arguments are kind of hitting right now, is that it's very technically challenging to provide these linkages and treat these files as quote unquote modern attachments. And there is, the federal rules do have, and FRCP Rule 26B1, six proportionality factors. And the sixth factor is whether the burden or expense of the proposed discovery outweighs its likely benefit. So obviously, if there is a lot of burden, then the benefit has to be even greater than that. Certainly, we can all agree to that. That's in the rules. But one of the things I think people are kind of saying when they're talking about this is they're saying, well, it's difficult, but they're not quantifying it. And I've covered plenty of cases where there have been objections and there have been boilerplate objections as overly broad, unduly burdensome, disproportionate to the needs of the case, not reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. That's a boilerplate objection. Boilerplate objections really are not going to cut it here. There should be specificity regarding that burden. And then you've got something you can work with to say, okay, you know, these are the steps we're going to have to take to go through it. These are the, you know, processes involved. This is what the cost looks like. And you can go through and say, okay, well, if the cost is huge and the case value is not near as, you know, as huge, then you can say, okay, it's burdensome. The benefit doesn't equate. And you can say, then it's not proportional. But I think that's the key, is you need to have that specificity to make those determinations.
So Doug, what lessons about specificity can we learn from the Metapixel litigation? And listeners, we will link to that case in our show notes.
Yeah, and that was one of the cases I originally linked to in my initial post on the topic. Unfortunately, I feel like that case doesn't really prove my point at all, because at least based on the very short opinion that was written by that particular judge, there wasn't a lot of information provided in terms of what the specificity was. Meta was able to just make a convincing argument, apparently, in the hearing that it was going to be burdensome. But we didn't get any details on that. So that's been a very frustrating case to me, because we don't really have a case where the court went through and said, but you know, one party's saying we should be able to get it, the other saying we shouldn't have to produce it. And with very little information in the ruling, the court decided that Meta didn't have to produce the modern attachments, and that the requesting parties could request them individually as needed. Which honestly seems to me like a very unsatisfying result, because you don't always know which emails are going to need an attachment based on the content of the email alone. So I'm still hoping we'll have a case ruling come down the pike where there hasn't been an ESI protocol agreement beforehand, and the court will go through the process of saying, here's why they should or shouldn't, in detail and with something that we can hang our hats on.
Before we move on from this case, though, Doug, in your professional opinion, do you think that Meta demonstrated an actual burden or more of a metaphorical one?
I've never met a burden that they haven't been able to successfully present. So if you want a pun answer to a pun question, yes, I think the plaintiffs met their match in that one.
Oh no!
You are so going to regret getting me started on this.
I will not. We have a family group chat, and my husband, I think, rues the day that he married into it, because it's just puns and dad jokes, like back and forth. Like, we will beat a dead horse of a pun for like days, and he's just like, "Oh, this is torture."
That's pretty fun. Well, we were just wrapping up assumption 5, and I didn't know if you had any other thoughts, Doug, on proportionality and how litigants should deal with that in terms of hyperlinked attachments. Do you have any other insight that you'd like to share?
I think it sort of ties into my post today, because I think one of the things about proportionality and the burden of treating them as modern attachments is that burden is continuing to change and evolve because the technology is evolving. And we've seen that over the past few months, where Google provided a capability for admins to be able to go and provide and pull those linked files. And Microsoft Premium eDiscovery is providing a collection of cloud attachments, is what they're using, the terminology they're using. And the technology is evolving. There are some challenges and limitations still to it, but the burden and the proportionality is shifting as a part of that. What's burdensome today may be less burdensome in a year. And so I think that's one of the things to keep in mind. The other thing that I mentioned today is that we're talking about all of these and the federal rules and all this sort of stuff, and they only tie to litigation, which is just one use case for e-discovery. There's plenty of other use cases for e-discovery. There's investigations, internal and external. There's HSR second requests. Are you really going to tell an investigator from the FTC or DOJ, no, I can't produce that, it's a modern attachment? They're going to look at you like, yeah, sure, you need to produce it. It's not going to be always that you can say, oh, it's too hard, it's too burdensome. Companies are having to find a way to do this. So to me, I think those are going to be some of the factors that ultimately push this issue down the road, and it's not going to be so much the burden question anymore.
I want to ask you a little bit about your thoughts, specifically about Google's rollout back in December, because I feel like that made pretty big waves, or at least in my neck of the woods, it did. What's your thought on the power of being able to like establish that link between the parent email and any hyperlinked files? And more specifically, the power of being able to link to a specific version of that document, i.e. like maybe the original version or the contemporaneous version or today's present version. How do you see this affecting the debate here?
Well, it's going to affect the debate in a couple of different ways. But from what I understand with the Microsoft Collect Cloud Attachments capability, it collects all the versions of the document. Do you want to just produce all of them? That's a little bit of a challenge as well. So ideally, it would be a case where you could say, you know, the technology gives you the ability to go right to that particular version you sent at that particular time and kind of run with that. And to me, I think that's the thing that we're hopefully heading towards with regard to these solutions. A lot of these solutions do keep track of the edits and the updates. And if there's version control in certain systems, then you should conceivably be able to get back to that version at a particular time when it was sent, and just work off of that. And that is a one-to-one comparison to what we've had with embedded attachments all along. That file could have subsequently been edited, but at the time it was sent, it looked like this. And if we've got an ability with a hyperlink file to say, at the time it was sent, it looked like this, and that was how it was when it was the part of the communication, to me, that's a one-for-one trade-off in terms of what you're getting and should get. And I'm hoping that the technology will head that direction in both accounts. I think Google's they've kind of pushed along in that regards. I had read something where I think Google wasn't saving every last edit. It was like one edit or one version saved a day, which doesn't necessarily guarantee that it's the version sent, but I'm not sure if that's true or not. There's still a lot of areas I want to do some technical research on to really get a sense of what's possible today and where the limitations still exist.
How do you think that this version history collection, what do you think the interplay between that and deduplication will be?
Oh, wow. I mean, that's definitely another consideration. You've got multiple versions of a file, but they may all be a little bit different. So,
yep.
Are we talking near dupes now? How do we get into that? Another thing I think, how do you preserve? I mean, you have literally an entire repository of files that could have been linked to emails. Do you preserve the entire repository when there's litigation? How do you go about that? So to me, there's a lot of challenges from identification on through collection. In terms of figuring out how you're going to make sure you can pinpoint. Again, my hope is that enough information would eventually exist that you could say these custodians' emails potentially relevant, any files attached to those potentially relevant, so we preserve those, but not the entire repository. But I've certainly seen that as a concern. It's like, okay, how can we do it when we really don't have a clear picture on what is, you know, potentially relevant or not? Did we lock it all down? That's tough. That's a tough thing to have to deal with.
Wouldn't it be cool if you could tell your software, hey, preserve any hyperlinked files, preserve the version contemporaneous with any email that was sent linking to it, and then preserve the current version?
That would be great.
And that would be so cool.
If you can send off emails to Microsoft and Google and Slack and folks like that and say, please do this.
If they would listen,
we wouldn't have to have this discussion. But yeah,
well, then what will we talk about?
Yeah, right. I know. Yeah, but you know, this also, I mean, one of the things we see is that a lot of development of platforms like this don't think about e-discovery at the time. They, you know, you have to deal with it after the fact. And then
it's so rude of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So rude. Yes. Yeah, really. Come on. Yeah. Okay, so Doug, I know you've mentioned, like, we've hit on a couple of the big cases. So we've hit on Noom, we've hit on StubHub, we've hit on Metapixel. You know, why do you think it is that we haven't seen more rulings about this issue other than, you know, those three? What are the pitfalls of those? And what kind of case law do you want to see going forward?
I'll answer the last question first, because it's, I think, the easiest one. I want to see cases that involve that are pre-e-discovery or pre-ESI protocol agreed upon parameters, where it's like, they're because like Metapixel, one of the good things about it was the parties were arguing over it. They were trying to finalize the ESI protocol and they weren't agreeing. And the court came in and they made a ruling. They just didn't make a very detailed ruling where we could get a lot from it. So I'd like to see
again,
that scenario.
So rude.
I know, right? Well, but you know, what are you going to do? There were two pretty notable decisions made in that case, and neither of them had a lot of information. And, you know, of course, I get it. Sometimes you got to move on and what have you. But I'd like to see cases like that where they are pre-agreement and courts actually making a ruling on, you know, how to handle it. There was a case last year, different issue, but it was the Lurisol versus IBM case where they were arguing over just how many, if you had a responsive message in a collaboration app, how many messages before and after to give context to the responsive message that you have to produce. And the court ultimately took the plaintiff's proposal saying 10 messages before, 10 messages after. To me, that's making a decision that, you know, has some, you know, kind of usefulness behind it. So I'd like to see more decisions like that where the court's saying, no, this is what's needed to be produced and here are the parameters for it. And I think we'll see that. As far as to why we haven't seen that many cases, I think that it's not a long-lasting issue. Sometimes the parties have agreed up front, or sometimes they've gone ahead and they've sorted it out on the ESI protocol and so forth. There's one of the cases that I found, because when I did a search for, you know, hyperlink files, modern attachments, what have you, there was the In Re Acetaminophen case where this was just a memorializing of the ESI protocol. But they had clear language in there that they were going to treat hyperlink files as modern attachments. I think they even used the phrase modern attachments. I thought to myself,
dirty words.
Right. I know. and the producing party agreed to that. And I thought to myself, well, it's a good thing they have a lot of acetaminophen because they're going to need it.
they're going to be in pain.
Right. Exactly. So I think that's, you know, I think that's in some instances, we're not seeing more cases because they're agreeing. But I also think that there's usually a lag of, it was a few years where Slack was being used, by more and more organizations before we started seeing cases involving Slack data. We're just really starting to see cases on Teams data. And I think we're going to continue to see more cases on the hyperlink files, modern attachment issue, but they're just going to be kind of coming here and there.
Yeah, I know we've talked a lot about the ESI protocol today, and that's one way, just as a reminder to some of our listeners, that's one way the parties will agree before they even get into the discovery process. We suggested in our last episode that you would understand this before you even get into your processing of your data prior to the review process. But these are all ways that we can agree to standardize the process of how we're handling data. I know that you've got a project ongoing, Doug, in terms of the ESI protocol. Do you want to share a little bit of that with us and any other projects that you have ongoing to help standardize this?
Obviously, one of the things I think you have to do is you've kind of hit this issue head on. And of course, ESI protocol is a great place to do that. My goal is now is to do a follow-up that's kind of like a take two, if you will. I actually did propose language for an ESI protocol on handling hyperlink files. I identified the assumptions addressed within the text. The only one that wasn't really in there was number 4. On hyperlink files should still be produced if they're deemed to be responsive. I tried to make sure we're talking about files, possession, custody, control, reporting on hyperlink files that are no longer available has to be proportional and parties can meet and confer if they get run into those issues.
Well, I know that we're coming to the end of our discussion here a little bit. And of course, you know, our listeners know to follow your blog religiously to understand more about this topic, especially guys, check out today's post. It's closely related. But where else would be a good resource for people to learn more about this topic in particular?
I don't know how many other people are writing about the issue per se. I think there's probably been some posts out there. Certainly, I would kind of do a I do searches out there for modern attachments. I was at the Masters conference last week. That was one of the areas, I get all my case law from Kelly Twigger's eDiscovery Assistant site. And they actually do now have a modern, I think it's a modern attachments or maybe hyperlinked files or linked files, I think, category. So if they get new cases, they'll be going into those. So that would certainly be a way to keep up with the case law involving it, because I think there's actually another case, but the judge didn't really make any decision. The judge just noted that they were disagreeing and there wasn't enough information to make a ruling. So it wasn't a very useful case. But that's certainly a way to keep track of the case law, because the issue's been brought up a few times. It's become a topic at conferences. So certainly that's one area to look for. But I would say keep your eyes peeled. I'll certainly write more about it. You know, join in on the LinkedIn discussions when, you know, people have things to say about that. And more people agree than not on kind of a reasonable approach.
No, we can shove this down people's throats until everyone agrees with us.
that always works.
We are an industry that can't even agree on how to spell our own industry.
Okay, there is one right way, and it is how you spell it on your blog, and I will die on that hill.
Yes, and 80 cents. And actually, I noticed that Alicia Holly has a LinkedIn post up right now. And I think last I checked, is 87% people agree it's eDiscovery, all one word, no dashes. With a small E, big D. Still, we can't get everybody to agree on that. So I don't know.
When Angie and I started talking about doing this podcast together, that was one of the first things that we discussed. And I was like, you do know that that's the right way. She's like, I know. That is the right way. I'm like,
it's like, oh, well, good. Otherwise, we couldn't work together.
I know.
That's right. Yes. You can't work with those people. That E-dash thing. What do they think that is?
Perverts.
Well, I'm going to close this out here, but before Perfect. I Angie, do you have any other questions? Or Doug, do you have anything else that you would like us to ask so that you can hit on additional topics?
I guess what I would say is, you know, that these are the types of things that eDiscovery geeks like us deal with, you know, regularly. And that's kind of, I mean, you have to have a certain mentality to find this stuff interesting and fascinating. And I think the three of us do. Obviously, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about it. And that's kind of,
what is wrong with us?
That would take a whole nother hour to probably, you know, get into that.
That's a whole new episode.
But I mean, that's to me, one of the things that I find interesting and fascinating about this job is there's always challenges and issues and things like this. There's technical challenges, there's legal challenges, there's logistics challenges, AI is throwing the mix into all this. We haven't said AI all day, but you know, it's just always, it's never a dull moment in eDiscovery. This particular issue just illustrates that point.
I mean, Bree and I don't get paid for this and choose to do this in our free time. So
exactly.
That should tell you something about the level of passion we have.
That says it right there.
Or the level of mental problems that we have.
Of illustrating it, yes.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for coming today. And I really mean that. I mean, we like to joke around a lot. We love humor, of course, dad jokes. In all sincerity, thank you for taking the time to talk to us, and not only talk to us, but educate us on a topic that is very freaking confusing. And everybody's trying to kind of battle in their own way how to deal with this and how to resolve their own issues with those two dirty words.
Just a big, big thank you, Doug. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. To our listeners, thank you for listening. Please reach out to us on our socials. You can find us on LinkedIn at eDiscoveryChicks. You can also email us. That email address is admin@eDiscoveryChicks.com. And we will be back in your feed in a couple of weeks with a continuation of our EDRM series. So look out for that as well. And until next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.